Welcome to the Cornell Sesquicentennial Celebration and to our program on 6 degrees of separation. Our program celebrates 150 years of Cornell's contributions to networks that bring people together across vast distances, from the telegraph network of Ezra Cornell to the discovery of small world networks in recent years. Small world research addresses a puzzling empirical finding that each of us may be just 6 handshakes away from a firefighter in London or a rice farmer in the Yangtze Delta. And this finding has been confirmed in at least 3 independent studies, 2 of which were conducted by scientists who will be speaking to you this afternoon. 6 Degrees has also been made into an award-winning play and into a movie by John Guare, who will be speaking to you as well. So, have you ever had this experience of traveling in a distant land and you meet a complete stranger and having a little conversational small talk, and you discover that you know someone in common, and someone will then remark, "It sure is a small world." But this is really a puzzle, because how can the world be so small if there are over 7 billion people? Moreover, it's not just the number of people that makes this 6 degrees of separation such a puzzle. It's also the way that we're connected. Social networks tend to be highly clustered, which means that our friends are also friends with each other. So a chain that goes from friend to friend to friend to friend to friend may actually not go very far, no matter how many links in the chain. The chain of friends just wraps around itself in these dense clusters. So in a highly clustered world, in which everyone is connected to their friends who are connected to each other, how is it possible that people are, on average, just 6 steps away from one another? Well, this puzzled social scientists for about 3 decades, until the mystery was finally solved right here at Cornell University by the 2 people who will be speaking with you today, Duncan Watts and Steve Strogatz, along with John Kleinberg and Lars Backstrom. But first, we'd like to show you a clip from the movie version of 6 Degrees, followed by a comment by its author, John Guare, who made the video because he could not be with us today.
I read somewhere that everybody on this planet is separated by only 6 other people. 6 degrees of separation. The President of the United States, a gondolier in Venice, just fill in the names.
Hello.
How everyone is a new door, opening into other worlds. These aren't just big names, it's anyone.
Hello.
A native in a rainforest of Tierra del Fuego and an Eskimo. I am bound, you are bound, everyone on this planet, by a trail of 6 people.
Hello.
6 degrees of separation between us and everyone else on this planet. It's a profound thought. But Paul found us.
I'm so sorry.
Why does it mean so much to you?
God, Vlad, how much of your life can you account for? Answer me! How much of your life
can I account for? All of it!
What did you want from us?
Everlasting friendship.
6 degrees.
Stockard Channing, Will Smith, Donald Sutherland. 6 degrees of separation, directed by Fred Skepsey.
You have to find the right 6 people to make the connection. 6 degrees.
This whole concept of how many degrees of separation between everybody on the planet, It started not as a philosophical concept, I believe it's a statistical concept in the early part of that last century, in the early 1900s, you know, the turn of the century, the 1890s to 1900, of how many stations, when the whole world was starting to be connected, thanks to Marconi, how many stations would you have to go to find the person you were looking for? And I think it was about 5.82, something like that. And then I was at Yale in the early 60s, and there was a man named Stanley Milgram, still a very controversial person, doctor, who would devise tests to see how far people's cruelty level would go. There were shocking tests where people would pretend to be shocked by electrical currents that he was pretending to put in them. And he would give people the power to turn on that electrical current. Stanley Milgram also brought up the concept of how many people there were, these 6 degrees between you and me and everybody else on the planet, which again was some sort of sociological concept. And again, I always been fascinated by that I can find anybody on the planet, except in America, if you're below a certain level, you fall between the cracks. And that was the ironic statement that I wanted to make. But man, I remember a couple of weeks or something after the play had opened, there was the front page of the New York Times said, the lead story was that there are only, it was 1990, and they said, there are only 6 degrees of separation between Bill Clinton and the presidency. Well, I said, that has nothing to do with the concept, with my play. But I loved that suddenly it got sucked into the conversation. It became a byword. Even in 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, games happen to be, and there are bars called 6 degrees. And it's just there. But I'm very, very happy that the play was a great joy to write the play. It was very satisfying and a great pleasure to make the movie. I was tremendously happy with Fred Skepsy's production of the movie. And I'm very happy that the fact of the play and this concept of 6 degrees of separation gets me invited to be part of this panel on the sesquicentennial of Cornell University. Thank you very, very much on this beautiful spring day. Thank you.
I'd now like to introduce our panelists. Our first speaker, I'm going to introduce them in the order that they'll be speaking. Our first speaker will be Duncan Watts, the author of the book 6 Degrees, The Science of a Connected Age. Duncan started working on the problem of small worlds as a graduate student in theoretical and applied mechanics at Cornell in the late 1990s. He went on to become a professor of sociology at Columbia University and director of the Human Social Dynamics Group at Yahoo Research. Today, he is principal researcher at Microsoft Research and a founding member of their New York City lab. He publishes regularly in the most prestigious scientific journals and has been awarded academic honors in both the physical and social sciences. He is currently an A.D. White professor at Cornell, which means that he will be a regular visitor to campus for the next few years. Following Duncan, our next speaker will be John Kleinberg. John received his B.A. from Cornell and his PhD from MIT, and then returned to Cornell, where he is now Dean of Computing and Information Science and Tisch University Professor. John is a winner of the MacArthur Genius Award, as well as the most important prize in computational mathematics. And in 2011, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. His research has addressed yet another side to the puzzle of 6 degrees, how people are able to navigate social networks to find these short paths. The next speaker will be Lars Backstrom, who earned his BA and PhD in computer science at Cornell. He then moved to Facebook, where he uses network science to improve your Facebook experience. He is currently head of the team that runs the news feed. So if you ever wonder how Facebook decide what goes into your news feed, you can ask Lars. If you ever wonder how Facebook decides which friends to suggest that you connect with, Lars did that too. So Facebook is changing the way a billion people interact, both online and off. And Lars is changing the way Facebook does that. Our final speaker will be Steve Strogatz. Steve is the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor of Applied Math at Cornell, with degrees from Princeton, Cambridge, and Harvard. He has worked on yet another puzzle, how interdependent actors spontaneously coordinate. Steve is one of the world's most highly cited mathematicians, and at the same time, one of the world's most highly acclaimed science writers. His four books show how mathematics can capture not only the synchronization of crickets, but can also capture the undulation of a suspension bridge, the romantic pendulum of Romeo and Juliet, and perhaps most importantly, how mathematics can capture the popular imagination. So I promised you that we would reveal the secret of 6 degrees of separation, and who better to do that to start us off than the person who made the discovery, Duncan Watts.
Thanks, Michael. So this story began almost 20 years ago, just over there in the engineering quad in Steve Strogatz's office, when I was a graduate student. And as you know, often happens with breakthroughs in science, we were thinking about a completely different problem. We didn't know about Stanley Milgram. We didn't know about John Guare. We were studying crickets, and we were trying to understand how populations of crickets that live right here on the Cornell campus in the late summer managed to synchronize with each other so perfectly, even though they're sort of spread out all over often quite large areas. And so while we were trying to understand this problem, I had a conversation with my dad on the phone one night, and he said this thing where he asked me, you know, have you ever heard of this idea that everybody in the world is connected to the President of the United States by just 6 handshakes? And I hadn't heard of that idea, but I thought it sounded kind of curious, and I wondered if it were true. And if it were true, would it be possible to prove it? And if it were possible to prove it, did it have anything to do with this cricket synchronization problem that Steve and I were working on? Because these crickets are all kind of listening to each other as well, but they're not all listening to each other equally. They're connected to each other by some kind of network, but it wasn't a network that we had a good language for describing in mathematics. And so what Steve and I did was we came up with a language for trying to understand networks that were like the networks of crickets and other sort of complex systems in the world. And the way we did it was this sort of roundabout construction that you see up here on the screen. You know, if you were trying to sort of measure the number of links between everybody and everyone in the world, the obvious thing that you would do would be go out and map out that network and count. And that's something that Lars will tell us about later on. But back then, we didn't have Facebook, and we didn't have any of these large networks, so we had to use math instead. And we did this sort of roundabout method of imagining what all, not just what the world looked like, the network of the world, but what all possible networks of the world could look like. And so over here on the left-hand side, you have this world where everybody's sort of standing around in a ring and they're only friends with the people who are standing right next to them. And in that kind of world, you have a lot of the clustering that Michael just mentioned, where your friends are friends of each other. But you also have this problem that to get from anywhere on the ring to anywhere else in the ring, you have to do a lot of hops. So this is a big world where there's no 6 degrees of separation, but there are friends who are close to each other. On the opposite extreme, you have this sort of randomly connected world where everyone is choosing their friends randomly from the population of 7 billion people. And in that world, it's possible to very easily show that it does have this 6 degrees phenomenon, but it's a very strange world because none of your friends are friends with each other. And so these are the two kinds of extreme worlds that you could imagine in this little universe of possible networks. And what we did was just simply mathematically tune our way between them in this very sort of smooth way. And what we found was that even just introducing a tiny little bit of randomness into this sort of structured world on the left-hand side gave us these two properties that we were looking for, this You still had the property that your friends were all friends with each other, and yet the path length between you and everyone else in the world had plunged dramatically, almost to the point where it was just like the random network on the right. And so from this mathematical construction, we were able to make a pretty big scientific claim, which is that not just social networks, but all kinds of networks ought to have this small world property. And we looked at a few of these early networks back in the late 1990s, and we were able to show that those networks are networks of movie actors and power grids, power stations in a grid, and even neurons in the brain of in the nervous system of a worm called C. elegans, all had this small world property. And so we sort of convinced ourselves that this was something that we ought to find in the world, that it should have important consequences for how systems behave, whether it was systems of humans or systems of crickets. But the one thing that we didn't get around to figuring out was the question that Weezer, Stockard Channing's character, brings up in the movie, which is that even if it's true that people are 6 degrees away from each other, how do you find the right 6 people? And that's something that John cracked the next year.
So I had just come to Cornell, actually, when Duncan and Steve's paper was published. I had been out on the West Coast in the mid-90s thinking about web search and how to make web search better. And this idea of trying to find things in a network. And when I saw their paper, I went back and looked at some of the literature on all of this. I read Stanley Milgram's paper about the 6 degrees. And the amazing thing was he, too, had been really setting things up as a search problem and trying to solve a search problem. This is actually a hand-drawn picture from his paper in Psychology Today showing how his experiment worked. The idea from this was, right, I mean, Lars will later tell us about how you can do this when you have the entire Facebook network on a single set of hard disk drives. But, in the 1960s, with pencil and paper and an experimental budget of $600, which is what Stanley Milgram had, what he did was he sent out letters to people in Nebraska. He said, from his position at Harvard, Nebraska felt like sort of far enough out there that it was going to be a fair test. And he 200 people, and he asked them, I have this friend who lives in Sharon, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. We're trying to test this idea that you're all 6 steps away from them, right? No, just a random person, not the President of the United States. I'd like you to take this letter I've sent you, and I'd like you to mail it to a friend of yours, someone you know on a first-name basis, with the goal of advancing the letter as quickly as possible to this person. And then his friend sat there, and letters started coming in. And actually, a lot of the letters came in, and the median number of steps in these chains was 6, which is the number that John Guare then discovered and gave it this name, the 6 degrees of separation. But I was looking at this as a computer scientist, and sort of what amazed me was that no one had asked the question, why in the world did this succeed, right? He had sort of asked them to do something very complicated, right? It's something that we ask the internet to do when it routes packets, but something you don't normally ask the population of the United States to do, which is to try to route these letters without the help of the postal system to this stranger that they've never met. How in the world is the network set up to do this? It didn't have to be that way, right? We look at the network, so the letter is zeroing its way in on the target. We could have lived in a world where the 6 degrees were there, but as Stockard Channing says at the end of the clip, that it's sort of hopeless to find them. But the world didn't turn out this way. The world turned out in this sort of much more tractable, friendly sort of way in which you can actually route the letters to the place you're trying to go. And so I played around with models for this. I tried to take some of Stephen Duncan's models, which didn't really have this issue built into them. And what you could find actually is that some of the key is that the network has to be set up the way it sort of looks in this picture, which is that each of us has friends at many different scales of distance. So we know a lot of people who live near us, typically. That's not true of everyone. If you just move to a new place, you don't know anyone, that may not be true. But most of us know a lot of people who live very close to us. A lot of people who live, say, in our town or city, a lot of people who live in our county or state, a lot of people who live in our country, some people who live all the way around the world, right? So these 6 degrees of separation are also sort of these 6 scales of resolution, and you expand out. And when the letter is trying to get to somebody, right, when you're trying to find someone, you sort of use them in reverse. You zero in through the country, through the city, through the city, the town, the neighborhood, down to the block. And it's crucial that all those steps be there, if any one of them is missing. And so as we think about human society, if we didn't have those long-range connections, we couldn't make these big jumps. But it's sort of easy to forget in the era of cell phone communication and the internet, we also need those last few steps, right? The letter could get all the way to Ithaca, New York, and it somehow isn't going to find the person unless people in Ithaca, New York all know each other. And so it's really these scales of resolution that you need. And so then, of course, the challenge was now we had a sequence of models. We had Stephen Duncan's, we had this proposal I had that you needed these different scales of resolution. And this is still the year 2000, and it just was completely unclear how we were ever going to test any of this, right? I mean, and I remember at the time saying to people, you know, to really test this, you would need to somehow build a system where you could convince a billion people to all sign up, say where they lived, and say who their friends are, right? And when is that ever going to happen? And so, remarkably quickly, these systems and data became available, and that's something which, as Michael said, Lars is now really at the center of it, Facebook.
Thanks, John. I came to Cornell in 2000, and I was an undergrad here, and then as a grad student from 2005 to 2009, I worked with John on a bunch of these sort of social network questions, and we looked at a bunch of what are now, in retrospect, relatively small graphs of only a few million people. And so when I was working with John, I learned about all these kind of like small world and the theory behind it, and it was sort of clear that these things existed, that there were these paths that you could find, that people could actually do it. But we'd never been able to sort of see at a large scale, you know, what did the entire social graph look like. And so then in 2009, when I graduated and went to Facebook, one of the sort of obvious questions to start asking was, well, cool, now I am at the center of a company that essentially has a large fraction of the social graph of the world. And at the time, Facebook was much smaller than it is today. I think there were only a few hundred million people on it, whereas today there's over a billion. But even so, it was still a significant fraction of the world that was connected to the internet, and obviously it's sort of leaving out large segments of populations that don't have internet access, but a lot of people were on, and you could sort of imagine that this was a good cut of the entire network. And you can kind of see, I think this is what it looked like a couple years ago, that you really do see people everywhere that there's population density, right? And you see all of these kinds of long-range connections that John has talked about. They're obviously much more sparse. But you can kind of see how these packets would get across the ocean from one country to another. And unfortunately, when I got to Facebook in 2009, even then the graph was much too large for us to kind of easily solve this problem, easily look and say, like, for any two random people, what is the shortest path between them? You could kind of pick two people and, you know, figure it out and, like, do this search algorithm and for any, like, two given people. But if you really wanted to know what's the distance between all pairs of people, that was sort of an intractable problem, right? Because there's hundreds of millions of people, hundreds of millions squared, very difficult computational problem, even at the scale of Facebook. And so it happened that when I was in India, actually, for a conference in 2011, I ran into these guys who were from Italy, and they had just been working on how do you find all pairs, shortest paths on large-scale graphs. And of course, they're not actually taking every single pair, because that would be computationally infeasible, but they can approximate it. And when you're talking about something this large, you don't have to get the exact answer. The sort of statistical approximation works out. And so in 2011 and 2012, we were able to go and take the entire Facebook graph and look at how far are people actually apart. You know, so we sort of knew that people could find paths that were, you know, six hops. What is the actual shortest distance between any two pairs of people? And through that analysis, we found it's actually six is pretty efficient. Most people are four or five hops apart. And so the fact that people could actually find a path that was almost the shortest in the entire world was quite impressive. And so we were able to go and look at this kind of macro level. What is the network? Examine this thing that we sort of theoretically knew was there but had never been able to study in such depth. And since then, there's a lot of other kind of analyses that we've been able to do. Now that we have a sort of ever-growing sort of view of the social network, we're able to look not just at that kind of macro level of how far apart are people, but also start looking at some of the finer grain structures of, you know, what do relationships look like? What are the social networks of those two people? Can you kind of find people's relationship partners using just the social graph? And really study the social network of people in a way that was never previously possible. Right? Because we have all of this data about all of these people from so many different walks of life, and you can now see in a way that was never previously possible, what do social networks actually look like for people?
Well, let me enlarge the discussion a little bit from networks of people to talking about all of science and why I think all of us up here probably agree that networks may be the future for so many different branches of science and for solving many of the major unsolved problems that confront us today in all disciplines. That is, this is much bigger than sociology and much bigger than network theory or mathematics. I mean, this is really the future of science that we're talking about and technology. So I want to begin by going backwards in time. What you see on the screen may look to you like a Christmas tree, but actually this is a naturally occurring phenomenon. Those are fireflies on a tree in probably a mangrove tree near Bangkok. So if you go along the tidal rivers in Thailand, every night of the year you will see trees filled with fireflies, male fireflies, that are flashing on and off in perfect unison. This has been known for hundreds of years. I mean, of course, the people who live in Thailand have known it forever. But as far as Western travelers to Thailand, the earliest report we have goes back to Sir Francis Drake in 1577. His ship's logs show that his crewmen noticed this unbelievable spectacle of mile after mile of riverbank filled with these trees that blink on and then blink off and on and off in perfect harmony. Except, how is this possible? I mean, what's causing this? And, well, it's these little creatures, these beetles that are fireflies. And, you know, we have fireflies here in Ithaca and all through the United States, but they're rugged individualists. They do not particularly flash in unison. They can't seem to get their act together, and they're not interested in getting their act together. They're independent operators. But these Southeast Asian fireflies do somehow manage to fire in sync. And this is considered quite puzzling because these are not the cleverest creatures on the planet. Now, the earliest theories about how it was possible, you know, if you ask a group of people to get in sync, usually they have to follow a conductor. There has to be a maestro or a leader. And so there was the early theory that there was some maestro firefly. But no one has ever been able to find that firefly, and you might also imagine that biologically it wouldn't make much sense for there to be one, because what if it got eaten by a bird? You know, then would the whole phenomenon fall apart that night? That's not how it works. It's not that there's a master firefly. It's also not due to the weather. Some people thought it had something to do with the humidity in the jungle. In fact, the explanation we now know today is that fireflies organize themselves through some mysterious cooperative process. That is, they look at each other. In addition to flashing, they're responding to the flashes of others. And somehow, through that give and take of flashing and responding to flashing, they spontaneously synchronize. And they do this, like I say, every night of the year. So I bring them up as a metaphor for what I think is really the great problem of science today, which is self-organization. Or to put it another way, how is it that you can have a group of individuals that somehow collectively do something fascinating and important? I mean, if you think about, say, what the challenges are facing the geneticists working on the Human Genome Project, maybe we should go to the next slide here. We now have these incredible diagrams of all the different, this is actually not a gene diagram, but I mean, if we want to make sense of the human genome, we have something like 20,000 different genes coding for different proteins. And what I'm showing you here is just a little portion of the circuit diagram that controls shows the main molecules that are responsible for cell division. Now, you will know that cell division is the thing that goes haywire in cancer. Cells just keep dividing when they should stop. Cells keep growing when they shouldn't. And so, now it's too small for you to see, but there's one little part of the diagram up in the top right. It says P53 box. P53, you may know, is a very famous tumor suppressor gene, which when it malfunctions because it's been mutated, this seems to be the case in about 50% of all cancers. So understanding things like cancer is now not just a problem of biology, but the choreography of the activity of all these different enzymes and proteins and parts of a cell. That is, we're not gonna solve cancer by, maybe you just watched the show actually about cancer on PBS the other night. Emperor of All Maladies, which made the point that cancer is We hoped that oncogenes would solve it, or that by understanding tumor suppressor genes, we would solve it. But actually, it's this intricate choreography going wrong in the cell. So what I think here is that when we're talking about networks, yes, it's Facebook, yes, it's Stanley Milgram and Six Degrees, but you should see this as the central challenge for understanding biology today, for thinking about the economy, for thinking, obviously, about terrorism networks. Pretty much every science today, you know, mapping the brain, we have the project called the Connectome. President Obama says we're going to map everything in the brain and figure out things about Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and the normal functioning of the brain. This, too, will be a giant network problem. So let me leave it at that, and I guess we're now ready to have a panel discussion, and then soon we'll invite you to participate.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. So it's clear from all the things that you guys have said that Cornell has played a leading role in the development and advancement of network science, as well as computational social science. Is this just luck, or is there something about Cornell that encourages breakthroughs in this area and the advances that have happened at Cornell? What's the secret?
It's a good question. I mean, one thing that's always, you know, drawn me to Cornell is, you know, just the kind of radically cross-campus collaborations, you know, which you have going. And actually, you know, just before this panel, as we were, you know, in the preparations, we were trying to map out all the connections that, you know, we have among ourselves, among the organizers, and the number of ways in which, you know, joint advising of students, you know, joint things across graduate fields, joint grant proposals. You know, I think a lot of that, Cornell has really been set up and to really make that possible. It's become a challenge because when I first showed up, the idea that Cornell was interdisciplinary was actually sort of a novel concept. Now, of course, the word interdisciplinary has become so generic that people just sort of say it and they don't even think about what it means. And, you know, I think a challenge for us here is to really, you know, how do we sort of keep that narrative going where, you know, in a world where it's become such a cliche to talk about interdisciplinarity. You know, I think it is deeply built in Cornell and its graduate field system, in Wegmans, where I've certainly had a lot of research ideas when I bump into people. You know, I think the idea that, you know, and I think there's something to that, that, you know, when you talk to colleagues who are at universities in really big metropolitan areas, you know, really the only time they see their colleagues is when they're sitting next, you know, next to each other at faculty meetings or in the office. And somehow I think there is a notion that, you know, we get along with each other here in part because, you know, you're going to see people on the weekend, you'll see them at the farmer's market, and, you know, and these aren't just your colleagues, they're also your neighbors, they're really part of the community, and, you know, I think that's both good for the collegiality, and I think it's just it's a healthy thing for an institution.
Let me jump in on to reinforce John's point there, because maybe you think he's kidding about Wegmans. That's really the key thing, not just Wegmans and the farmer's market, but the idea that we get to know each other as friends, and come to trust each other when we see each other at daycare, whether it's for our kids or our dogs. That is, what's the point about trust? The point is that if you want to do interdisciplinary work, you have to admit what a beginner you are. You have to admit how ignorant you are about certain fields. So when I have worked with John, and I find that I know nothing about computer science, or with Michael, and I need to brush up on my sociology, it really helps to trust the person. That is to let your guard down and be vulnerable and admit what you don't know so that you can actually learn something and make progress. In a place filled with egomaniacs or with people who need to keep their academic armor plate up at all times, it's very hard to do the interdisciplinary work and to take the chances you need. And so I think that truly is a key to what makes Cornell successful. Something about Ithaca, something about Cornell. The institution itself, as many of you will know, has a certain modesty to it. And humility that goes back to Ezra Cornell, I think. I mean, I feel like I can see it in his statue. I mean, if you look at him, he's standing in front of his great invention. He's standing in front of the telegraph machine. You can barely see the telegraph. This is how modest the guy is. It's right there. Go look at that statue when you're outside and look at the back of the statue.
So it's sort of like the network structure of Cornell and Ithaca has given rise to the success of the study of network structure.
As a grad student, I always used to think that, you know, as I was sort of shivering through my first freezing cold winter here, I used to think, you know, the genius of Ezra Cornell was that he put his university in a farm paddock in a totally inhospitable place. because there's nothing else to do. So you just sit inside for 9 months of the year and you think.
And you can't get in or out.
And there was like a real, and you can't get in or out.
You're centrally isolated.
And it's very, it's a little bit of a bubble. You know, everybody here, you know, people don't have normal conversations at Cornell. You don't sort of say, what do? You say, what major are you, right? So there's sort of a, there's a really, there's a kind of exclusion of the rest of the world that you know can you know could you could see as a bad thing, right? If you live in New York City as I do, you know, these sort of you think, oh, it's so much more interesting to live here, and there's so much more diversity, and there's so much more, you know, connectedness with the rest of the world. But there's also something about sort of isolating yourself in a bubble and just kind of wrestling with hard problems for month after month after month. And it's hard to do that when there's a constant source of distraction and a constant inflow of people and all the things that you have in a big city. So I think it's both true that being here encourages the people who are here to interact with each other in a much more sort of extensive way than you would get with the Columbia faculty, for example, where everyone just goes home at night and goes to whatever else they're doing. But there's also this like sense, as, particularly as a student, where you're just here with your problem.
There's one more thing that I would add to what's been said. So 6 degrees of separation and social networks, that's really a social science problem. And yet, if you look around you on the stage here, I'm actually the only card-carrying social scientist on this panel. And the interesting thing is that some of the very best social science being done at Cornell is being done by people who are not card-carrying social scientists, but people coming from computer science, from applied math, from physics, from information science. And I think that's part of the culture of the institution, that people in areas that might otherwise be working on brains and crickets, also are really fascinated by the motion of social particles, not just those in the physical world, genuinely interested in it, reach out to social scientists to collaborate and work together on these problems. And I think Cornell is really fortunate to have this interest, this deep interest in social science, deep both in terms of deep questions, deep also in terms that it goes way back in the institution, this interest in social science from other disciplines.
I would also say that you know, something that's happened over the last 20 years is that the world has changed, right? And that the composition of people here on the stage reflects that, you know, 20 years ago, when you thought about networks, it was really a very theoretical exercise, right? That there wasn't a lot of data. You know, when Steve and I started looking around for examples of social networks to test our theory on, there were very few examples of networks that were larger than 100 people, because it was just practically too difficult to go out and you know, back then sociologists would go out and they would hand out survey tools to people and ask them, who are your friends, and you know, who are your colleagues, and who do you ask for advice, and this sort of stuff. And it's very hard to do that for a very large group of people, and it's also hard to sort of sit and observe the interactions between people. And so what has really sort of opened the floodgates to network data has been the web. And that's a technological revolution that has unfolded over the last 15 or so years. And of course, it's transformed so many other things in the world that you're all familiar with, like e-commerce and communication and dating and other forms of social interaction. But maybe less obvious to you, but certainly important to us, is that it's transformed how we do social science. That social science is becoming a computational field, and so computer science, just as biology did back in the 1990s. So sociology is going through that revolution like right now, and computer science is really a necessary partner in this.
I mean, I think these are problems that no one field can solve, at least as they're as they're currently organized. And you know, all the things I've been doing, and you know, I think everyone up here, we wouldn't be able to do them without being able to have really deep conversations with social scientists who are wrestling with these problems. And so I think it's really a case of several fields being stretched simultaneously outside their comfort zones and trying to find the point where they can all meet and do something genuinely new. certainly from the computer science side, the thing that the web really taught us starting about 20 years ago was that we're really building systems for human beings. I mean, parts of computer science were more forward-thinking, and they, saw that in the 1970s and 1980s. But I think the mainstream onrushing mass of computer science really woke up to that in a big way in the early 90s, when suddenly we had millions and then billions of people putting all this information online, engaging in this outpouring of self-expression and creativity. And we suddenly thought, this is what we're building these systems for. It's for people. And if you're really building it for these enormous masses of people, then you need to understand something about how they think individually. You need to understand how they operate collectively. You need to understand how the incentives that you create cause them to engage in new behaviors. In a sense, how the system rebounds against your best efforts to design it, because the system is populated by people with their own motivations and their own reactions to incentives. And so I think just as the social sciences are being stretched by the appearance of all this data, those of us in computer science are really being stretched quite dramatically by the fact that these systems that were, think of any big computer science system in the last 10 years, YouTube, Wikipedia, Facebook, Instagram, right? All of these are about assembling audiences and then allowing them to really sort of unlock something that's sort of bigger than any one of them individually.
This is really an exciting time to be a social scientist. Social science has struggled for a long time to be able to have data. It's very hard to observe human behavior. People don't want you to be observing them. We give out surveys, but those are to random samples, and those samples don't have people's friends and family in them, so we can't find out about their peer relations with surveys very easily. And we do experiments with, 20 college sophomores in the lab, and then try to generalize. It's really hard to do social science, but that's changing now. And this is an incredibly exciting moment in social science, because for now, suddenly, when it rains, it pours. We now have, terabytes of data, the digital records of people's online interactions thanks to things like Twitter and Facebook and other social media, Last.fm, that we have just incredible data on human interactions that I think is going to be transformative in the years ahead. And just as social media platforms like Facebook are changing the way we do social science, I think it's also the case that these social media are changing the phenomena that we're studying. Do you think that there are ways in which the entity of social networks, what we're studying, is changing before our eyes because of people choosing to interact increasingly all over the world, choosing to interact via these online social media?
Yes, one of the things that we looked at when we did this study to see how connected people were is, as the network was growing and evolving over time, was it becoming kind of tighter? So we could actually measure, pick two random people, and maybe, in 2009, they were four hops apart. Were they still four hops apart in 2012, or had some new connection been made that kind of brought them closer together? And you could actually see this in the data, that over time, as the network grew and as more connections were made, the world was actually getting smaller, according to this sort of distance measure. And I think that's continued, and you kind of feel that in your daily life also, that technology, and not just Facebook, but if you think about video conferencing or how easy it is to make international phone calls and how cheap it is compared to 20 years ago, mm-hmm. all of these sorts of things have enabled us, I think, to connect much more effectively with our sort of weaker ties. I'm much more connected to my friends and family who live halfway across the world than I possibly ever could have been 20 years ago, when it was $2 a minute to even talk on the phone, and I could email them, but that was never very efficient and things like that.
I think this is really a fundamental point, because we often, when we sort of get excited, we sort of wax lyrical about how the internet is to social science what the telescope was to astronomy, and that maybe there's this sort of glorious revolution in social science that we're about to see. But we have to keep in mind that because social science is about people, it's very different from studying ants or atoms. The ants don't care that you understand them, right? They just keep doing whatever they were doing before you understood them, and the fireflies are flashing exactly the same way today as they were 1,000 years ago, and they're totally oblivious to whatever math Steve comes up with to understand why they're doing that.
But everything that we build to try to understand human behavior changes human behavior, right? And so there is this sort of constant moving of the goalposts. So, you know, I think that, and I think that's actually a good thing, right? We wouldn't want to have a kind of mastery of knowledge of human behavior the way we seek to have a mastery of knowledge of electrons, right? That's not something that I think aligns with our sort of desire to be human, right? So I think it's good that social science is never going to be like physics. It's good that we're going to constantly have this process of reflection between understanding and the phenomenon itself. But it still allows plenty of room for improvement and for science to inform other things like business and policy and things that we care about.
But another difference with studying ants or brain cells, for that matter, when people are studying ants, we're not tempted to try to use our intuition to imagine what those ants are thinking and how they're feeling and how are they motivated. Whereas when we're studying people, we have that opportunity. We are one of the things that we're studying. We can then use our intuition to imagine how does the world look. Is this an advantage or a disadvantage?
It's one of my favorite things to talk about. So I think it's both, of course, right? I mean, it's you know, I think if we did not have the ability to sort of imagine why other people do the things that they do by reflecting on our own motivations and behavior, most of human behavior would be totally inscrutable. We would have no idea why people do what they do. So it's great for us to be able to generate hypotheses about each other, to have this powerful brain that can sort of simulate other people's behavior. But it also comes at a cost, which is that we have so much intuition for why people do what they do that we often are convinced of our own stories. We're convinced of our own explanations. And when we study ants or electrons, we also come up with stories. We call them hypotheses, but we don't trust our hypotheses, and so we use this thing called the scientific method to test those hypotheses. And over the last 300 years or so, that's been an incredibly powerful engine of knowledge creation, the scientific method. And one reason I think why social science has not progressed as quickly as some of the other sciences is that because we have so much intuition, we don't use the scientific method. Why do I need to do some experiment to test a theory when I already know why, you know, I know why poor people are poor, I know why, you know, I know what to do about the economy, or I know how to, you know, someone just the other day was telling me how, you know, he would have prevented the financial crisis. You know, everyone's sort of totally convinced of their own theories of the world, and yet if we actually go and test them, most of the time we're wrong. And I think that what we're also seeing now is that as we get more and more data, it's becoming increasingly clear that we don't actually know what we're talking about, and we have to be more scientific, and that's a healthy thing.
Can I ask you something about that? I mean, when you bring up the scientific method for social sciences, I think there are a lot of people, I mean, this occurs to me, I bet to some of you too, that social sciences make it very difficult in principle to do some of the things that you associate with the scientific method, like controlled experiments, for instance. That is, it's hard to keep everything constant except one variable when it's people or societies. So are you in a way taking an unfair shot at the social sciences by saying it's been a failure to use the scientific method? Maybe it's impossible in principle.
You know, I think that randomized trial controlled experiments really are the gold standard across the sciences, especially for trying to figure out causal processes, to understand what are the mechanisms that are producing the patterns we observe. And it's always been difficult to run experiments in social science, in part because we don't want to hurt people. I mean, there's the ethical considerations, but also just scale. I mean, we run these experiments, as I was saying before, with a handful of college sophomores in the lab who are not necessarily acting the same way people outside off campus would. But again, this is also changing, and in part, I think, because of social media creating platforms where we can run enormous experiments with much larger numbers of participants. There are online labor markets. For example, Amazon operates an online labor market, another called Crowdflower, where at very low cost, you can have thousands of participants in an experiment from across the globe and all different walks of life. Facebook and other social media are running experiments 24/7 to improve the user experience. But sometimes these dovetail with academic interests. The study that a collaboration between Cornell and Facebook to study emotions and how emotions are communicated from person to person. That was last spring. Now, some of you may have heard about this. So I think that's a change that's happening for the better.
Let me give a slightly different answer. I think you're absolutely right. There are experiments that are of course impossible in principle. You can't go to war with half of Iraq and not with the other half and see which one works out better, right? So there's lots of limits to the sure. to the scientific method, but there are also limits to the scientific method in physics as well. We can't split the universe in two and change the gravitational constant in each half and see how that changes the overall expansion or contraction of the universe, right? So there's plenty of things in all disciplines where it's not possible to run controlled experiments, and I think that what's happening is that the gap is closing a bit, right? That there are going to be plenty of examples of things that we care about in social science where we can't. We either continue to not be able to gather the data that we're interested in, or we continue to not be able to run experiments. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of things where we can now that we couldn't before, and I think
it makes me wonder if when you mention that the internet may be the telescope for social science, maybe that's very good as an analogy in the same way that, as you say, in astronomy, you can't do controlled experiments. So astronomy is a great observational science, but hard to, so is that really the analogy?
So when Lars and his team learned something about the network and put that into the system, they also changed the network. Right. And that's very different. I think that's also an argument really for, how we're trying to educate students, say, here at Cornell. You have people at these companies, so you're at some startup, which is, recommending music, streaming music to people, and suddenly, overnight, you've amassed an audience of 25 million people, 50 million people, and it's you and your four friends who just got BAs in whatever you got BAs in, and you're sitting there and you're making decisions day after day. So you say, I have to recommend some songs, and I want to show, should I show a friend who liked it? Should I show how many people liked it? Should I show, three friends who liked it? These are all decisions, and they have, psychological consequences, they have market consequences, the reaction, the kind of stodgy academic reaction would be, let's assemble a team. Let's get the psychologist here and the economist, and let's assemble a focus group. But there's no time. You're writing code, and this thing is hurtling forward like a rocket. You're going to make some decisions, and you're going to draw on not just your intuitions, but hopefully on the courses you took. You're going to draw on your education. And I think having that mix of backgrounds so that, you understand how to build the systems, you understand the statistics of design experiments, you understand the social psychological principles, you understand the privacy implications. Mm-hmm. It's going to be one or two or three people in a lot of those cases. Sometimes you have time to assemble the whole team, great. But, the number of these decisions that are getting made, is several orders of magnitude bigger than the number for which you can really convene some kind of process mm-hmm. like that. And you're going to be relying on people with their undergrad educations that they got here or they got somewhere else, to sort of have that kind of balance of backgrounds, I think.
So the thing that I think is interesting is, a lot of the challenges that you mentioned would apply to, say, medicine or something, too, where you have to be very careful, and they've obviously, that's gone pretty well. I think one of the kind of unique challenges to a lot of the kind of network science is that you're measuring effects not just on one person, but you're trying to understand the entire network, and you have all these different connections, and the things that you do to a small number of people are going to potentially affect everybody, and now it makes it actually very difficult to measure this. And you might think, I'm in a pretty good position to run these kinds of experiments, and we do that a lot, as Michael mentioned, to try to make the user experience better. We're always kind of, trying to change the UI or the way we do ranking or things like that in order to improve Facebook. But even at Facebook, one of the things that we really struggle with is, we build some new feature, which we think is great. We're all really excited about it. And of course, we're trying to be scientific. And so we run a test that's, a randomly controlled experiment. And you see that this feature has some impact on the fraction of the people that you tested on. But it's very hard to predict how that's going to go, both over time, as how are people going to use it in the longer term, but then also how is it going to change when everybody uses it? Mm-hmm. And the example that I always like to use is, imagine that you built a chat service, right? So imagine that Facebook had already existed. At some point long ago, there was no chat on Facebook. And imagine that some engineer built chat for Facebook, and they ran it. They wanted to run a test. They wanted to run let's see what happens if we give 1% of people chat. And now, of course, that would be a miserable failure because I would have chat. I'd be in the test group, and I'd be able to chat with 1% of my friends. And I would think, well, this isn't a great experience. I'm probably going to go use some other chat service. And those kinds of challenges, that's obviously a very extreme example, but you can kind of imagine how that plays out and how it actually presents somewhat unique challenges to the scientific method, because you're trying to imagine what would happen if you were to expose everybody to this.
I think a lot of the features of Facebook, because I mean, the chat's a great example because, right, if you have no one to chat to, then it looks like it. But, you know, even, you know, you give someone a better photo uploading experience. I'm just going to make up an example because I'm not building these things. But, you know, a better photo uploading experience to 0.1% of the population. Now, that's going to have spillover effects because, you know, you upload photos more fluently. So your output stream now has more photos, so your friends see more photos, they go, hey, that's kind of a good idea, maybe I'll upload more photos. You didn't even give them the new photo uploader, they just saw you using it, and they just modeled your behavior. And so you can have things leak out of your test anytime you're trying to create a social experience, even if it looks like an individual.
But there's actually, let me share with you a somewhat bigger problem so as a social scientist, I'm sort of living in both these worlds, the social science world and the computer information science, applied math, sociophysics world. Let me share with you a little bit of the pushback that I hear from social scientists against these interlopers coming in from outside. And if I could just use the analogy of Duncan's wonderful quote, we finally have our telescope with social media. Okay, we have the telescope, but do you know where to point it? And the criticism is that people doing social science who are not card-carrying members are data mining. That's the thing that I hear the most. Just collecting data sort of mindlessly, running some statistical tests to look for patterns in the data, and that's the end of it. Where's the theory? Any thoughts on that?
First of all, you know, I think in any science, you know, there's the phase where you just try to figure out what's there, right? And so when you look at, you know, network science, whatever you want to call it, network science, this new merger of computation and social sciences, you should judge it as a science that's 10 years old. And you should ask what physics looked like when it was 10 years old. And you should ask what economics looked like when it was 10 years old. And I think all of these engage in a kind of, you know, there's a phase where you're sort of groping around and you haven't found the light switch yet, right? And so you're just sort of like feeling, you know, sort of trying to figure out what's going on, and you're sort of mapping out the terrain. And I think all sciences go through that. It's sort of a necessary step. You don't know what you're building theories of otherwise. And in a sense, sciences that sort of start building theories too quickly are building theories of not very much. But I think it's a huge challenge. It's something that, you know, we need to start bringing theory. And I think actually what we started with here in this panel, 6 degrees, is an interesting case of something where, in fact, there was a lot of theory building that, in fact, a lot of it got validated, right? So, in fact, the number of, you know, hops and the kind of balance of clustering and path length that Stephen Duncan saw shows up in Facebook. The kind of distribution of scales of resolution, you know, that are necessary for searchability, which, you know, originally came out of a theorem I was trying to prove, also shows up in Facebook. And so I think, you know, we are starting to see the beginnings of things where the theory actually, in some cases, precedes what we're finding. But we certainly need more of those as the field gets older.
Michael, if I could suggest, I think the audience may want either comment or ask questions. We have microphones for you up here in the front. So we'd be happy to react to whatever is on your mind.
People are coming up.
We'll go on before they come.
The question that you asked, that I think it's absolutely true. There are plenty of examples of sloppy research that have been done by non-social scientists. But I think the other comment is also true for, you know, if you look back over the last 100 years of social science, there's a enormous number of theories about why people do what they do. And many of these theories are inconsistent with each other or even sort of flagrantly in conflict with each other. And yet they sort of all continue to sort of coexist because we haven't had the data to be able to sort of reject them. And so I think that really what we are looking for is a disciplining process where you keep the theory, but you also have the data, and they talk to each other in such a way that both of them get better. And I think that's sort of what we sort of hope to see as the field matures.
Yeah. Very nice.
So I have two questions which may or may not be related to one another. In human societies, would the number have been 400 years ago? And maybe related, has the internet strengthened weak ties and weakened strong ties?
So it's a great question. And So the number, I think the number went down, certainly. I mean, I say with complete authority, I don't know. But, you know, I'll say this. In a world where very few people ever travel more than, you know, a few hundred miles from their birthplace, it's going to be hard to bring the number down in a world that's 25,000 miles across. We certainly know from the very first book Cornell ever did in the freshman reading project, Guns, Germs, and Steel, was in effect about how, you know, if you look back 20,000, you know, 10,000 years ago, the world was actually quite segmented, you know, and that allowed, you know, between the Americas and the Europe-Asia landmass, and that allowed, for example, diseases to evolve independently. And that meant that when those two groups were brought together, it had incredibly destructive consequences. And so we know that the shrinking of the world can be quite cataclysmic in some cases. But thanks for bringing up the point about weak ties, because I think one thing that social media like Facebook have done that's very subtle is on the weak tie part. The strong tie part is a good question too. But on the part of it, so Glenn is referring to strong and weak ties, the balance between your very close friends and your very distant acquaintances, the so-called weak ties. It's changed things dramatically but subtly where, say, when I graduated from high school, and I've used this anecdote of my fellow panelists previously, but when I graduated from high school, I was in a gym with 200 people at our graduation ceremony. And on that day, I permanently lost touch with probably 160 of them. You know, sure, if I worked really hard, I could find them. But I don't know, you know, are they married? Do they have kids? What jobs do they have? Do they still live in, you know, upstate New York? I don't know these things. And I feel like that actually has changed, that people graduating from high school now have this expectation that they're going to be kept in touch. You know, they're going to be able to remain in touch with people that they didn't, you know, that they sort of knew growing up, but not very well. And that's because you have this computational prosthetic that's helping you. Right, that kind of lightweight connection where someone that you don't know very well, you're not going to hear much, but every few years when they get married, they change jobs, they have a baby, you're going to hear about it. Facebook enables us to do that because that's a connection that's too lightweight, I think, for humans cognitively to be able to maintain. It's either above that level or it's zero. But Facebook can maintain that forever on your behalf, and it's going to tell you those things. And I think that's really, it's sort of an amazing change to your picture of what does your life look like and what does your whole lifespan reaching back to childhood look like that I don't have. There are ways in which I'm cut off from my childhood that I think people now aren't. And that's really thanks to having this sort of assistance from Facebook that makes that possible.
Can I just make the opposite point though, which is that, and this is also somewhat surprising, is that, you know, back in the early 1990s, some sociologists tried to answer the question, how many friends do people have? And the way they did this was a very clever trick where they, because if you ask people how many friends they have, they have no idea. They tell you the wrong number. They usually underestimate wildly. And so they used this trick where they asked you, how many people do you know called Michael? How many people do you know called Stephanie? And how many people do you know who are airline pilots? And using this trick, they were able to back out an estimate of how many total friends people had. And the answer was surprisingly similar to what we see on Facebook today, that the average was a few hundred and the maximum was about 1,500. And so another sort of underappreciated phenomenon that's happening with Facebook is it may not be that we have more friends now than we used to, it's just that we have Facebook counting them for us. And so it feels like we have more, right? All these, you know, John knew the other 160 people in that high school gymnasium, but if you asked him 2 years later to name his friends, he wouldn't have thought to list any of them. So there's a certain amount of just a measurement effect.
There's a measurement thing, but I think there is a notion that I don't know what's going on with them, and I think
and
now it's possible.
That is also true. Yeah.
Yep. Yes.
So if political science is not an oxymoron, I wonder what network research tells us about whether the political network, in terms of political views and communications, right, is in fact less connected than the social networks, right, you deal with in general.
So, Michael, you think about polarization a lot, right?
We're studying political polarization. We're actually using Twitter to collect data and looking for the alignments of political alignments of people. Also using Amazon co-purchases. So we've been looking at the ways in which the people who read, for instance, science, what do they read in politics? And surprisingly, we found that sociology is not the most left-wing of the sciences from the standpoint of the readers of the consumers on Amazon. It was engineering. That's
engineering,
right,
is the most left-wing.
Engineering was the most left-wing.
I think engineering is the most right-wing.
In terms of popular science. So when wow. that is to say, the people buying popular science in the engineering category on Amazon are buying also left-wing books. We're trying to use these data from online sources to map the ideological alignments of various phenomena. Also lifestyles, we've done the Fortune 500. Most liberal of the Fortune 500? Facebook. And in the past we would have used surveys, but by using data, these digital traces of people's interactions and their purchasing habits, we could get, I think, a richer understanding of how political alignments are shifting and changing, and in some cases, fissures forming.
What about the dynamics of it, though? Is it changing?
Well, that's one of the limitations, is that we can't go back farther than our data, which doesn't go back too far because social media is fairly recent. There is evidence out there from using more traditional sources that the polarization is greatest at the top in Congress, not as much in the population as it is among the elites, and also that it's been deepening since about the mid-1970s. And also one of the things too that our research has shown is that polarization, it's not just people taking more extreme positions on issues, it's that their positions on issues come to be correlated with each other, so that I can predict your views on gay marriage by knowing your views on gun control, or your views on the war in Iraq, or on abortion rights. So it's these the fact that issues come to be correlated is that we are seeing at the population level. Even though we don't see people taking more extreme positions, we see people taking more correlated positions. Yeah, one last question.
You mentioned Stanley Milgram at the outset of this discussion. His best-known experiment, of course, was highly unethical, involved deception and lack of informed consent, violated the Nuremberg Codes. You also mentioned the Facebook Emotional Contagion Survey, which also involved deception and lack of informed consent. My purpose here is not to lambast anybody, but to ask unwitting or witting participants in these social networks, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, or whatever their successors will be, what can we do to protect ourselves against this sort of manipulation? How can we recognize it, and whether it's done by the companies themselves, by government actors, by non-government actors, what can be done about that?
You're not from the IRB, are you?
No, I'm not.
Yeah. So I think there are two answers to the question. One is that we need to sort of adapt the procedures that were, introduced about 30 years ago that have sort of morphed into university institutional review boards. So there are procedures for reviewing human subjects research that need to be, I think, adapted to this new digital age, where we're able to sort of the boundary between experiments and observation is sort of blurring, and the difference between surveys and experiments is blurring. So there are a number of people here at Cornell, and also even where I work at Microsoft Research, who are sort of actively thinking about how we should structuring sort of ethical review of all human subjects research. And I think that's something that's very much in our interests as the research community to kind of get out in front of, to make sure that we're being transparent and we're able to build trust among the people who use all of these different products. But I think there's another larger point that answer will not address, which is just that the world, and it's not just the web, but in particular the web, is moving in a direction where experimentation is just a ubiquitous activity that all companies, if they're not already, will be sort of constantly tweaking things and showing one set of people one thing, another set of people another thing, and then measuring to see which one works better. And it is going to be sort of a universal fact of life that
that you're going to be in hundreds or thousands of these experiments, you know, on any given day. And, you know, I think that's something that we need, again, to make sure that people understand, and so that they can approach the life online with that knowledge. And I think that's, you know, if we go back to sort of the 1920s when, you know, public relations was just being invented, you know, they were pretty sneaky about stuff, and they were able to get people to, you know, they made the famous example is smoking. The tobacco companies targeted women in particular because it was, and they sort of covered this as a sort of civil rights issue, that women should express their freedom by smoking. So, you know, that's sort of something that today, it probably wouldn't work, because I think that we're much more savvy about marketing now as a society. And I think that, you know, going forward, this will sort of all become normalized.
I'm glad you brought up the question, because it's, I think, implicit in a lot of this. And it's a very hard question, which, you know, a lot of us have wrestled with. I guess I would say three things. So one, on the point of manipulation, you know, the sorts of A-B tests that companies do on products is an example, and we should watch for that. But, you know, I think one thing the internet has taught us is to be sort of able to be more savvy about manipulation in all dimensions, through advertising, like Duncan said, through the news media, which, you know, draws a lot of its revenue through manipulation, you know, through politics. All of this is about, you know, us becoming more educated about the many, many ways in which I think, you know, the system is designed to, you know, to manipulate things. And so that educating people to watch for those things is very important. On the subject of experimentation, since that's what we're talking about, you know, I think I would also distinguish, you know, I think all four of us, all five of us up here, if I could count correctly, would have different, you know, different takes on this in a nuanced sense. But I would certainly distinguish between principles and implementation, right? So the Belmont Report, which laid out the ethical framework for experimentation, I think, you know, says a lot of things that are absolutely, you know, the case in which we absolutely have to, you know, have to adhere to, and I think everyone agrees on adhering to it. Then there's the question of how do we specifically implement, right? Because a lot of those recommendations were expressed in general terms, and a lot of the IRB apparatus that we have is then an attempt at an implementation of those principles. And I think you always want to try to make sure the implementation matches, you know, the systems which are available. So it's always been a work in progress. You articulate principles, and then you try to match the changing world with them. And then I think the final point is that, you know, with Facebook or Amazon or Google, This notion that you're constantly testing your product, there is no other way to do it, right? I mean, the point is, you know, Google wants to know what color blue to show for its links. It's not like there's some default answer, right? You know, this notion that, you know, well, why don't they just use the regular color? What is that, right? So, you know, every single part of the page, every single part of what they show you, those are all decisions that have no default answer. And so in some sense, the only way to do that is by showing some people one version, some people another version, and we'll see which one is better.
But John, sorry, why can't some people just opt out of being participants? But why couldn't it be that I don't want any experiments done on me online,
right,
and other people like you maybe would say, I don't care, this is the way it has to be. You can experiment on me.
So the point is, there is no default. I mean, you could opt out of using Facebook.
No, I don't care. Whatever default they get by experimenting on you, I'll accept. I'm just saying, don't experiment on me. Leave me
alone.
Experiment on you.
This has traditionally worked quite badly because so there are these things where, like, you know, we got our beta tester group to do something, and who are the beta testers? They're these sort of techies who sort of have complete disregard for certain things that most people care about, and you end up with a product that's useless to most people, right? So in some sense, you end up with a bad experience doing that. We could say that's just the cost of doing business, maybe, but one has to understand the cost of that, which are quite extensive.
That's a good answer.
I think it's sort of, you know, people say this thing like it's uncontroversial that, you know, I believe in an evidence-based approach to policy, right? Most people in this room would say, of course, we want an evidence-based approach to educational policy, economic policy, whatever. You know, that evidence comes from trying different things and mm-hmm. comparing them. You don't get the evidence-based approach without being able to try things out and see what works.
I think there's actually a really profound question here, which is that you know, and I've heard a number of people say this over the years, that they don't want to participate in experiments, or they don't want their data to be used for anything unless they get a direct benefit back, and that is explained to them. But and actually, many companies would be happy to sign up for that because, you know, as far as they're concerned, you know, like, sure, you know, we'll only like gather your data to improve this product. But for science, that's really a terrible outcome because it's this problem of public goods, right? That you're contributing something to the understanding of the world. And if everybody says what you say, which is like, well, fine, I don't mind you experimenting on other people, but just not me, right? And everybody says that, then nobody learns anything. And then we're back in the world where it's impossible to learn anything.
But Duncan, I mean, you know, social scientists have been running experiments for years with college students, and we don't force them to be in the experiments. They get to choose. And I don't see, and I don't see why that can't be extended to online populations as well. I do think we are out of time. So I get to have the last word on this. Just in closing, I want to thank our panelists. I especially want to thank David Easley, the Henry Scarborough Professor of Economics, who organized this panel. I'd like to ask you all to give David a big hand. And thank all of you for coming.